Hey, I'd like to welcome you guys to another edition of Bible Answers with Dr. Phil Fernandez. As you know, he's the president of the Institute of Biblical Defense and the senior pastor at Trinity Bible Fellowship located here in Bremerton. He also teaches Bible and philosophy at Cross Point High School located in Bremerton. How are you doing today, Doc?
Doing real good, Pat.
Hey, so we're still in your book, Hijacking the Historical Jesus, Answering Recent Attacks on the Jesus of the Bible. And you can get a copy of this, and I highly recommend you getting a copy of this. You can get it at Amazon.com, look at Phil Fernandez, or look up Phil Fernandez, and that's Fernandez with an S. You'll find probably two or three pages worth of his books, and I recommend every single one of them to put in your apologetic library. So we're still in chapter 6 where we're talking about the New Testament reliability, and there's a section that I want to read, and it's the opinions of the experts. So the testimonies of some of the world's leading experts can be called upon to further verify the authenticity and reliability of the New Testament manuscripts. Dr. John A.T. Robinson, one of England's leading New Testament critics, came to the conclusion that the entire New Testament was written before the fall of Jerusalem in A.D. 70. Sir William Ramsay was one of the world's greatest archaeologists. His thorough investigation into the book, or into Luke's book of Acts, led him to the conclusion that Acts was a mid-first century document that was historically reliable. William F. Albright is one of the world's foremost biblical archaeologists. He stated that there is no evidential basis for dating any New Testament book after 80 AD. Sir Frederick Kenyon was one of the world's leading experts on ancient manuscripts. His research led him to conclude that the New Testament is essentially the same as when it was originally written. Amen. Miller Burroughs, the great archaeologist from Yale, stated that there is no doubt that archaeological research has strengthened confidence in the historical reliability of the Bible. Burroughs also stated that the skepticism of liberal scholars is based on their prejudice against the supernatural rather than on the evidence itself. F.F. Bruce, New Testament scholar from Manchester University in England, stated that if the New Testament writings had been secular works, no scholar would question their authenticity. Bruce believes that the evidence for the New Testament outweighs the evidence for many classical works which have never been doubted. Bruce Metzger was a famous textual critic from Princeton. He has stated that the New Testament has more evidence in its favor than any other writings from ancient Greek or Latin literature. It is clear that the evidence favors the authenticity and reliability of the New Testament. Scholars who do not allow their base or their bias against the supernatural or influence their conclusions have concluded or have recognized this fact. Scholars who reject the reliability of the New Testament manuscripts do so because they choose to go against the overwhelming evidence. However, such a rejection is not true scholarship. It is an a priori assumption.
Yeah, an a priori.
Oh, and a priori. Yeah. I have a hard time saying that word. Assumption. If one uses neutral presuppositions rather than liberal, anti-supernatural presuppositions, then the outcome is clear. The New Testament portrait of Jesus is historically accurate. And here, you kind of end your book, or in this chapter, not your book, you're talking about Jesus' inner circle. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, it's the way I concluded about Jesus' inner circle, I basically show how just very few key authoritative leaders who were in Jesus' inner circle, you could trace all the New Testament books back to their authority. Let me just say this, though, before I get into that, on that a priori assumption.
Yeah.
A priori means that basically means that you make your decision before looking at the evidence.
Okay, that makes sense.
A posteriori means you make your decision after looking at the evidence. And so what I'm saying is these New Testament scholars that reject the New Testament as being historically reliable, they do so based on an a priori bias against miracles.
So they already presume that there's no miracles.
Yeah, miracles are impossible, okay. So I don't believe the New Testament is reliable, and I'm going to try to prove that with wild speculative theories. If you get rid of that a priori bias and you come at it where you're actually going to look at the evidence, then the case for the historical Jesus is really, really clear.
Yeah.
Now, with Jesus, getting back to your question about Jesus's inner circle, when determining what books belonged in the New Testament, the canon of the New Testament, canon means the list of books that belong in the Bible, but the three tests for canonization that the early church had was, number one, is the book written by an apostle, or does it at least have apostolic authority?
Yeah.
Okay, so some apostle gives a thumbs up, or it's a colleague in the apostle, one of the apostles, who is just an extension of the apostle's ministry. So does it have apostolic authorship or authority? Number two, is it in agreement with prior revelation? That's why all the Gnostic writings were rejected, because they were written too late to have apostolic authority, and they disagreed with the Old Testament revelation, because they believe the Old Testament God was evil and the Old Testament is evil itself. So was it in agreement with previous revelation? And then number three, is it edifying for the entire church? Is it profitable for the entire church? If it wasn't, then that particular church would just read a copy of the letter from the pulpit for their people and for their edification. If it was edifying for the entire church and it had apostolic authority and it wasn't heretical, it was in agreement with ancient, with the books already written, then they would turn around and make as many copies as possible and encourage the other churches to preach them from their pulpit. And that's how we got our New Testament. And so when they're looking for this apostolic authority, you say, well, why the 27 New Testament books and not any others? Well, the reason why there's not any others is because they failed one or all three of those tests.
Yeah.
And Paul, we know, wrote at least one, maybe two more letters to the Corinthians. Apparently, I doubt if he would have been heretical. He definitely had apostolic authority, so the only issue would have been, is it edifying for the entire church?
Yeah.
So I think the Corinthian readers realized that what we call 1st and 2nd Corinthians, they were edifying for the entire church, make copies, distribute them, have them preach from the pulpits. But the other letter or letters of Paul to the Corinthians, no, this isn't edifying for the entire church. This is something we need to hear and nobody else. Let's preach it from the pulpit and either hide or burn the letter. But it doesn't need to be spread around. Well, when you look at the 27 New Testament books, they were not all of them were written by apostles. But, you know, Matthew was an apostle, okay, so he's got apostolic authority. But if he wrote it late, you know, if he wrote it, let's say if he wrote it in the 50s or 60s AD, he would have been writing it under James's authority, James the half-brother of Jesus. I think he wrote it, though, in the 30s. Or the 40s AD, which means he early 40s AD, which means he would have been under Peter's authority. So even though he was an apostle who already had apostolic authority, he was actually probably under Peter's authority at that point. Mark also was under Peter's authority because Papias tells us that Mark's gospel was based on Peter's preaching. Mark took notes. He was the scribe. Yeah. For Peter, when Peter was in Rome. When Peter left Rome about 45 AD, Mark wrote down Peter's gospel. So it's Peter's authority. In fact, one of the early church fathers even goes so far to say that Peter read it and gave it a thumbs up and encouraged it to be, allowed it to be read from the pulpits. Luke was Paul's colleague. He wrote both Luke and Acts, so that's under Paul's authority. John wrote under his own authority as one of the big apostles, the Apostle John. Then Romans all the way through Philemon were written by Paul, so it's under Paul's authority. Hebrews, the author never met Jesus, Hebrews chapter 2, verses 2 and 3. So it wasn't Paul, didn't have the Pauline introduction either. The Greek is more advanced than Paul's Greek. Might have been Apollos who wrote it. That's what Martin Luther thought. But the author of Hebrews knew Timothy, and he knew Paul's theology. And so I think he was probably one of Paul's guys. So that's written under Paul's authority. James would have written under his own authority, James the half-brother of Jesus. Peter and 1 and 2 Peter would have written under his own authority. 1, 2, 3 John and Revelation, also written by the Apostle John under his authority. Jude was the half-brother of Jesus and the brother of James, so he would have written under James's authority. And so basically, if you place Matthew under Peter's authority and Jude under James's authority, every New Testament book can be traced back to Jesus' inner circle, Peter, John, and James, and Paul. Now, Paul's the apostle to the Gentiles, and he refers to Peter, John, and James as the pillars, the so-called pillars of the Jerusalem church.
Yeah.
So basically, every New Testament book can be traced back to the big four. This is Jesus' inner circle on steroids, if you will. So whatever the case, I think we have tremendous evidence that the New Testament is historically reliable. But not only that, I actually go a step further and argue for even earlier dates for the New Testament than most conservative scholars would argue for. There's some that agree with me, but most just don't want to go that far. But they don't like to disagree with New Testament scholarship. But I think when the evidence of the early church fathers, that for me outweighs any speculative theories of the liberal New Testament critics. And so I'm willing to push back the dates of the New Testament much earlier than most apologists today.
Yeah, and you make a point about the earliest dates, Matthew being wrote between 37 and 42 AD. And the paper that you just submitted this weekend was kind of shed light on the importance of dating these accurately and as early as possible when you're looking at this book. Because if he's writing something and he's saying something that's controversial or that some of the critics are saying that didn't happen, well, why would James or why would Matthew be saying this when these people are still alive? They would call him out on it.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, it's really, if you want to attack the scriptures, let's push the dates way back. Well, why do conservative evangelical Christian pastors and theologians, why do we just accept what the New Testament scholars give us when they have the incentive to date these books as late as they possibly can? Is it possible that they could have been dated earlier? And what are the earliest possible dates as well? And then we can work within those perimeters. I end up siding with those earlier dates in most cases, and we could look at that, you know, in the next program.
Yeah, definitely. So that's all the time we have today. So, instituteofbiblicaldefense.com or philfernandez.com. Not only to click on the donate button to help us stay on the air, they're great resources for apologetics. So philfernandez.com site, click on apologetic links, and there's all sorts of different apologists, links to their websites where the resources are there, not just for Pastor Phil's or Dr. Phil's resources, but they're all out there. Great place to go. You can also email pat316@gmx.com. That's pat316@gmx.com. Send us your comments, concerns, and prayer requests. Thanks. This has been Pastor Fit. Excuse me. Pastor Phil Fernandez and Pat Fisk wishing you all of God's blessings. Thank you. I'd like to welcome you guys to another edition of Bible Answers with Dr. Fernandez. Here we are still continuing in the book, Hijacking the Historical Jesus, answering recent attacks on the Jesus of the Bible. So we want to jump right into it. It's a good section. We just talked about the New Testament reliability. Spent quite a couple weeks on that chapter alone, which is really important because we're talking about God's Word and we're talking about His love letter to us. So we're going to jump into chapter 7, redating the New Testament books. So, I mean, right off the bat, I see the importance of it with this paper that you just submitted. to the ISCA, and it really was a light bulb that went on over my head, the real importance of redating them to the earliest possible dates, not just what the liberal critics give you, but going to the earliest possible dates.
Yeah, and it's one of those deals where, you know, like we talked about the Jesus of the gaps.
Yeah.
And if the New Testament critics can say, well, none of the Gospels were written until 60 AD, 67 AD or later, which is what they try to go for, they'll say, gee, we don't know what the Christians taught between 30 AD and 67 AD. And so they spin wild theories and speculate that the oral traditions evolved and that you turned a merely human Jesus in 30 AD into God, the second person of the Trinity, by 67 AD. Well, that's not the case. We've shown that there really is no gap because of the ancient creeds and the ancient sermons. And then Paul's writing as early as 49 or 50 AD. But I think we can actually argue for Matthew's gospel as early as the mid-30s AD. And Luke and Mark to the mid-40s AD. And John's gospel to somewhere between 50 and 55 AD. And see, the thing is, when you let liberal critics run the show, they're going to act like nobody was in a rush to write down gospels, that they were perfectly content just going with oral traditions. And then unknown people started writing a lot later, and they weren't really the authors of the Gospels that we have in our Bibles today, and when in reality, we got those names from the early church. The early church would know better than liberal critics coming on the scene 2,000 years later.
Amen.
And but they would argue that there would have been no real incentive for them to start writing. Bart Ehrman says, well, look, you know, here's a guy that questions so much in the New Testament. Then he finds one passage in the book of Acts where the apostles are called uneducated men by their enemies, the Jewish religious leaders. And he says, oh, so therefore the apostles were illiterate, and therefore they didn't write the gospel. Somebody else wrote them much later. Well, that's bogus. Number one, if you want to get an idea who Phil Fernandez is, don't talk to his enemies.
Yeah, exactly.
Number two, why does Bart Ehrman even think that passage really belongs in the New Testament when he questions so much else that's in the New Testament? And number three, they were being accused of being uneducated, which from the Jewish religious leaders, but basically what they were saying was, the apostles, how can these men teach these things? They were not trained in one of our accredited rabbinical schools.
Yeah.
And so they weren't trained in the school of Hillel or school of Shammai. And then the passage says, and then one of them realized, oh, that they were taught by the kind of unorthodox rabbi, Jesus of Nazareth. Well, once they realized they were trained by Jesus of Nazareth, that explained why they were teaching that way. So they were really not uneducated, just they were trained by a rabbi, Jesus, who the Jewish religious leaders didn't accept, didn't embrace back then. And then number two, by saying they're uneducated means they're not trained in our accepted rabbinical schools, but it doesn't mean they can't read and they can't write. If most Jews back in the first century AD couldn't read and couldn't write, then I don't know why just 200 years earlier the Jews had to translate the Hebrew Old Testament into Greek. I mean, if the Jews couldn't read Greek, why would you have to do that? So whatever the case, I think it's clear that they could write. And now the question comes up, would they have wanted to write? Well, yeah. Here they are. They go to the synagogue. They study the Old Testament scriptures. And God's word in the Old Covenant is given to them in written form, the Old Testament. So now they have the Jesus experience. He fulfills all these Old Testament prophecies. They realize he's their Messiah, their Savior. He died for their sins. He rose from the dead. And then he ascends to heaven, and they're not going to write about that. I think that they would want to start writing things down, you know, right away.
Well, yeah.
And so when Paul's letters, I think the reason why he doesn't give his own gospel as far as the birth, life, ministry, miracles, death, resurrection, and ascension of Jesus, I think the reason why he doesn't write his own gospel is because he assumes that his readers, who usually he's already visited them, on not so with the Romans, but usually his readers he's already, you know, planted the church, led them to Christ, and either orally gave them the gospel story, or
they already knew it,
or he gave them some gospel in written form, which would have been Luke's gospel, and so whatever the case, they already knew the gospel, but it seems to me that you don't need to write letters like Paul's letters unless at least a few of the gospels were already in written form and were being widely circulated. So I just plain question the idea that why would the gospels be some of the last stuff written? It should be some of the first stuff written. By the way,
because that's what's going to save.
Yeah. And everything, and with the letters, you're talking to people who are already Christians, who are already supposed to know all this stuff. Paul assumes they already know all this stuff. Well, how do they know it? Probably from reading Gospels that were written earlier. James, I date James' letter to about 45 AD, and I think that's what caused a lot. When that was circulated to Jews spread throughout the ancient world, it sounded so much like salvation by faith plus works, faith plus the law, which is not what James was teaching, by the way.
No.
But I think that's what led to the Jerusalem Council, because then Jews were going to Antioch and to other Gentile churches and telling them, you got to get circumcised and obey the law. So I think that James's letter was misunderstood and got the ball rolling. Well, James quotes like about 35 times from Matthew's gospel.
Yeah.
If James was written in 45 A.D., Matthew's gospel's even earlier than that. And, I mean, James is so early, he calls the church, instead of calling it ecclesia, a called-out assembly, he calls it the word that we get our word synagogue from.
Oh.
So he's writing so early that the church was like primarily Jewish. And so whatever the case, I think we can provide strong evidence that the New Testament was written much earlier than even our conservative pastors. See, most of our conservative pastors were trained by evangelical Bible-believing New Testament scholars who were trained by non-believing liberal New Testament scholars. And so a lot of the evangelical New Testament scholars accepted the earliest possible dates allowed by their liberal New Testament profs. But I believe that there's much earlier dates than that if we just allow the evidence to speak for itself. None of the, you know, John A.T. Robinson, he wrote his book, Redating the New Testament. He dated the entire New Testament to before 70 A.D., because the destruction of the Jewish temple is not mentioned as having occurred in any of the New Testament books. We already mentioned William F. Albright in the last episode, that he was one of the world's leading archaeologists. By the way, archaeologists and historians tend to date the New Testament writings earlier than New Testament critics.
They're not
as biased and all. But he dated every New Testament book to before 80 A.D., New Testament scholar John Wenham, W-E-N-H-A-M, John Wenham, a British scholar, he rejects the later dates for Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and argues that Matthew's gospel was written about 40 A.D., Mark's about 45 A.D., and Luke's gospel to the early 50s A.D. New Testament scholar Henry Thiessen wrote an introduction to the New Testament in the 1940s. He also gave early dates for the four Gospels. You even have Roman Catholic scholars such as Claude Tresmontant and Jean Carmenac and that dated the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, as early as the 40s or 50s. So whatever the case, there's no reason why evangelical Christians should accept without any question the late dates of the New Testament books that are promoted by the liberal New Testament critics. I like quoting from John Wyndham's work, Redating Matthew, Mark, and Luke, where he himself gives an interesting quote from the Yale scholar, an expert on Semitic languages. The scholar's name was C.C. Torrey. And C.C. Torrey said this in 1934, by the way, "I challenged my New Testament colleagues to designate even one passage from any of the four Gospels giving clear evidence of a date later than 50 A.D. The challenge was not met, nor will it be, for there is no such passage." And so, you know, basically, we've got this idea that these writings were written so late because that's what New Testament critics, you know, New Testament critics will say, well, you know, Matthew's gospel was written, you know, somewhere between 70 AD and 85 or 90 AD. So what we'll do is we'll say, okay, we'll take 70 AD.
Yeah.
But the thing is that these are liberal critics. Maybe it was even earlier than that. We don't have to accept the earliest possible date allowed by New Testament critics. We might need to look even earlier than that. And so that's probably what we'll have to talk about in the next episode. You know, this has gotten so bad that in order to date the New Testament writings later, the New Testament critics have to date the writings of the Apostolic Fathers.
Later.
Their pupils, yeah. And so so I think we can cut to the chase on this by first looking at the Apostolic Fathers, and maybe we could do that in the next episode.
Yeah, I think there's clear evidence that the entire New Testament was wrote before 70 AD. I mean, that makes a – I mean, you've already laid out a really good case, because the Jews at that time, temple work and sacrifice was the major part of their life and the religion. So you would think if the temple was destroyed that someone would have, because they're all talking to not only the Jews but the Greeks. It was such a major player in that society at that time.
Yeah. No, and I'm in agreement. And I mean, there's possible for a few of the books to be written after 70 AD, but I think it's doubtful. I think Robinson was onto something when he argued for all the New Testament books being written before 70 AD.
Amen. Well, that's all the time we got today. So this has been Pastor Phil and Pat Fisk wishing you all of God's blessings. Thank you. Hey, I'd like to welcome you guys to Bible Answers with Dr. Phil Fernandez. He's president of the Institute of Biblical Defense and the senior pastor at Trinity Bible Fellowship. He also teaches Bible and philosophy at Cross Point High School, located in Bremerton. This is Bible Answers with Dr. Fernandez. How are you doing today, Doc?
Hey, doing real good. How you doing, Pat?
Doing good. Definitely enjoying your book. Amazon.com. And look up Phil Fernandez, and that's Fernandez with an S. And you've got to have this book. It's Hijacking the Historical Jesus, Answering the Recent Attacks on the Jesus of the Bible. It's a great book. You got to have it in your library. So anyways, I'd like to say hi to all the listeners in Albuquerque, New Mexico, Richmond, Virginia, and Huntsville, Alabama. So we're continuing. And we're talking about in the section we're redating the New Testament, talking about the Apostolic Fathers.
Yeah, and the interesting thing with this is that the Apostolic Fathers, they were pupils of the apostles, selected by the apostles to lead the early church, and many of them were, you know, as the apostles were getting older, then they selected him. But when you really look closer, some of these apostolic fathers, maybe they weren't apostolic fathers. Maybe they were the elders.
Yeah.
And kind of in between the apostles and the apostolic fathers. Maybe they were the contemporaries of the apostles who just had a longer life expectancy because they weren't on the top 12 wanted list. But the liberal critics love to date the apostolic fathers as late as possible so they can move back the New Testament writings a little bit.
Okay.
And but I would argue that some of their writings should be dated earlier. For instance, the Didache, which is also known as the Teaching of the 12 Apostles, you know, many date that to 100 AD or later. Yet, when you look at it, a lot of the themes of the Sermon on the Mount are there, but it's very practical in its writing. It's concerned with practice and doctrine. Yet the church organization found in the Didache is very primitive. It's no more advanced, I don't think, than the church government of Paul's writings, 1st and 2nd Timothy, the 60s AD.
Yeah.
We have the elders and the deacons and things of that sort. They even talk about apostles as if some of the apostles are still alive. So the offices of apostles and prophets are still functioning. They talk about Friday. They still call it the day of preparation. So there's many ties close to Judaism. It's almost like Judaism, the Jewish faith, and Christianity had made a complete break. And still, Sunday is the corporate worship, the Lord's Day, even though they're still keeping the Sabbath day there. And for reasons such as this, John A.T. Robinson dates the Didache from 40 to 60 A.D. in his work, Redating the New Testament. Now, if the Didache predates 70 A.D., that's interesting because there's a lot of allusions to Matthew's gospel in it, as well as it may also refer to Hebrews, 2 Peter, the Gospel of John, Acts, Romans, and Revelation. So I actually think there's a good chance that the Didache should be dated in the late 60s AD, and if that's the case, it pushes virtually all the New Testament books to before 60 AD.
Well, yeah.
Clement of Rome, he wrote a letter to the church in Corinth. Now, he became the Bishop of Rome towards the close of the first century. So most scholars date this letter to about 95-96 AD. However, the position of elder in that writing seems closer to the way the elders were some 30 years earlier when Paul wrote 1 Timothy chapter 3 and Titus chapter 1. So the church government resembles the pre-70 AD model, not the second century model where some of the elders became bishops and were considered, you know, they were in charge of numerous churches,
yeah,
not just one. So whatever the case, but Clement held some kind of position. Paul even mentions him in one of his writings. And so Clement was not a non-important guy who then became Bishop of Rome. And so he held an important position for decades. And then Clement of Rome mentions that the temple was still standing when he wrote. Now, he does mention the martyrdoms of Peter and Paul, which occurred about 67 AD, so it had to be written after that. But he says the temple had yet to be destroyed in 41 verse 2, and of his letter to the Corinthians. So if the temple is still standing, the latest it could have been written was early 70 AD. Now, this is interesting because if his letter was written early 70 AD, he quotes from or alludes to Matthew, Mark, Luke, Acts, 1 Corinthians, Titus, Hebrews, James, 1 Peter, and possibly Revelation. I mean, the list goes on and on with what you can do with this. The Shepherd of Hermas is usually dated to the mid-2nd century AD, but John A.T. Robinson, he argues that that the church fathers, Irenaeus, Tertullian, and Origen, also all treated the Shepherd of Hermas as if it were an ancient document, not a second century document, when shortly before they were writing. And so whatever the case, if the Shepherd of Hermas If it was written earlier, then what you end up with, you know, the earlier it gets dated, then the earlier the books have to be dated that it quotes from or alludes to, which would be Matthew, Mark, John, 1 Corinthians, Hebrews, James, 1 Peter, 1 John, and Revelation. So, several of the apostolic fathers, the dates should be pushed much earlier than they actually are. Now, we do know Ignatius wrote his seven letters in 107 A.D. when he was en route to be thrown to wild beasts, and Polycarp wrote his letter around the same time when Ignatius was going to be fed to wild beasts. And so those eight letters, Ignatius is seven and Polycarp's one, and Polycarp was a pupil of the Apostle John. You can look at all the books that they quoted from or alluded to. And so whatever the case, there's some stuff I mentioned about Papias as well. You start putting all of this together, and you can make a very strong case for the Apostolic Fathers being written earlier, and then the New Testament itself. These New Testament books themselves being written earlier as well.
Yeah, they have to be written earlier. If someone's quoting from it, obviously it was wrote prior to that. Again, we talk about following the evidence. What does the evidence say? So the evidence shows that most of the books are wrote prior to 70 AD. It just makes sense.
Yeah, and that chart that I have on 156 and 157, Hijacking the Historical Jesus, is where I give the dates, where I date Matthew's Gospel to about 35 to 42 A.D., written by the Apostle Matthew. John Mark wrote Mark, I think, about 45 A.D. John Wenham gives an excellent argument that it's after, not after Peter departed the earth, it was after Peter departed Rome,
yeah.
And Peter had been there for probably a few years after he departed Jerusalem, and so a 45 A.D. date is not extreme. Luke probably wrote 45 to 50 A.D. You know, Paul mentions in one of his writings and about one of his colleagues who is famous for his gospel, and it's 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 18. And there it mentions that, you know, the his colleague who was famous for writing his gospel, or who is famous for his gospel. And some would say, New Testament critics say, well, he was famous for preaching the gospel. Well, who wasn't? Any of Paul's colleagues would have been famous for preaching the gospel. Paul had a colleague who was famous for his gospel. It was probably his written gospel.
Yeah.
That's the way the early church understood it. And so that pushes Luke's, the writing of his gospel, back to 45 or 50 A.D. In fact, a little bit later in the 60s A.D., Paul quotes from Luke and calls it scripture. John's gospel, even James Charlesworth of Princeton Theological Seminary dates John's gospel to the 50s A.D., Acts, a 61 A.D. date. We talked about that in a previous program. Romans, 56 to 58 A.D. In fact, all of Paul's letters written between 49 and 67 A.D. Hebrews has a pre-70 A.D. date. The temple is still standing. James, probably 45 to 48 A.D. 1 Peter could have been written as early as 44, maybe 65 A.D., 2 Peter, 67 A.D., right before Peter dies. 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, either the 60s A.D., some would date as late as 80 or 90 A.D. I favor the earlier dates. Jude, maybe 60 to 65 A.D., and then the book of Revelation, either 69 A.D., or some would date it as late as 95 A.D. But I think you could make a case that it is possible that all 27 books of the New Testament were written before 70 A.D. And so whatever the case, I think we need to look at not just what is the latest book, the latest possible date that the New Testament books could be written in, but also what's the earliest possible date. And when we do that and start looking at how early these books could have been written, we find out some tremendous things, and one of them is that the possibility that the entire New Testament was written before 70 AD.
Yeah, and the earliest book that you wrote, or not that you wrote, the earliest book that you date is Matthew, and that happens to be what you were talking about the paper that you submitted this weekend. So looking at that, I just want to emphasize.
Yeah, all the early church fathers believed Matthew was the first gospel to be written.
Yeah, exactly. So, and then you also point out that they all followed the creed, and was in 1 Corinthians, and one of the earliest creeds wrote within, 1 to 2 years of the resurrection?
Yeah, Marcus Borg and Gerd Ludmann of the Jesus Seminar were dated to within 1 year of the crucifixion, and they follow kind of the general outline. That's why there's so many similarities in the Gospels about the life, death, death, burial, resurrection, appearances of Jesus. And the evidence is overwhelming for much earlier dates than we've been given. Even some of the fragments we're now starting to find, you can make a case that some of these fragments are pre-70 AD fragments, copies of little portions from the Gospels.
Yeah, I just think it's really important. I think being an evangelical Christian and also being a pastor myself, we have to look at the earliest possible dates and not just give what liberal critics, people that don't believe, what they give us. We need to prove and be willing to stand up for the truth and the inerrancy of the Bible and the earliest dates.
Yeah, and I just think evangelical Bible-believing New Testament scholars need to have more courage and be willing to think outside the box.
Exactly.
And so the dates that I'm giving, they sound radical, but before evolutionary theory, this was the normal way we dated the New Testament books.
Amen. Well, that's all the time we got today. So wishing you all of God's blessings. This has been Pat Fisk with Dr. Phil Fernandez. Wishing you and hope you have a wonderful day. Thank you. Hey, I want to welcome you guys to another edition of Bible Answers with Dr. Phil Fernandez. We're in the studio today with Doc again. As you know, he's the president of the Institute of Biblical Defense and the senior pastor at Trinity Bible Fellowship. He also teaches Bible and philosophy at Cross Point High School located in Bremerton. This is Bible Answers with Dr. Fernandez. How you doing today, Doc?
Oh, doing real good there, Pat. How about yourself?
Doing great. Hey, so we're still in your book, Hijacking the Historical Jesus, Answering Recent Attacks on the Jesus of the Bible. It's a great book. Excuse me. Definitely a must. Sermon audio, or not sermon audio, but go to Amazon.com and look for Phil Fernandez, and that's Fernandez with an S. In the book section, come up with like 2 or 3 pages worth of books. You can find it there. It's a great book, a definite resource that you need to have in there. So anyways, we're in chapter 8 right now. Is Jesus just another myth? Like to obviously turn off. It's a long subject, so we can get right into it.
Yeah, well, and the thing is, in that chapter, the chapter's kind of brief, and I wish I had lengthened it. And, you know, we were just at the conference, the Bellevue, Washington Worldview Apologetics Conference, and I gave a lecture on it, and I spent about an hour refuting the Jesus myth hypothesis, the idea that Jesus never existed and he's only a myth that the early church borrowed from pagan myths. And I really only got through part of my message there. And, you know, I could probably give a 4-part series on it. So one of these days I'll have to either write a little book or do a new edition of Hijacking the Historical Jesus and beef it up, because there's just so much here. But what I'd like to do first is just recommend that if you want to look into this, because this is becoming very, very popular, we're going to see that Bart Ehrman, the leading anti-Christian New Testament scholar, he acknowledges that no credible scholar teaching at a fully accredited university in the areas of Bible, religion, or history denies Jesus' existence. It's so obvious. There's so much evidence for Jesus' existence. So, but you do see this is real popular on the Internet, with Internet atheists, younger Internet atheists, who probably don't know a whole lot about history, like most Americans don't know much about history anymore. It's been a significant dumbing down of our culture in certain subjects. But if you want to look into it further, J.P. Moreland in Scaling the Secular City has about 5 to 10 pages that deal with this. And he gives you a summary of the work of Ronald Nash, Christianity and the Greeks, a great book on the subject. Kind of a little technical there, but Mike Lacona and Edwin Yamauchi, it's probably Lee Strobel's least popular book, yet it's my favorite one of his, is The Case for the Real Jesus.
Yeah.
I think it's even better than The Case for Christ because it's so up to date. And they have he has a couple chapters on refuting the Jesus myth hypothesis. And Mike Lacona and Edwin Yamauchi's contribution there is just phenomenal. And Paul Eddy and Gregory Boyd wrote an entire book, about a 400-page book, The Jesus Legend, where they refute the idea that Jesus is only a legend. J. Warner Wallace, the cold case detective guy.
Yeah, neat guy.
Great guy. Really likes me because I got a law enforcement background myself. And spent a lot of time with him and Frank Turek in North Carolina last time I was there for the National Apologetics Conference. We went out to eat and everything. And
yeah, we've watched him speak before. He's a great speaker.
We were kind of sharing back and forth stories of mafia relatives and stuff. And
nice.
Yeah, he's from the Boston area. His relatives are earlier on. But J. Warner Wallace, his website deals with this issue.
Cool.
So he's got a lot of good work there. Mary Jo Sharp, probably the greatest living female apologist that I know of, and Professor Mark Forman of Liberty University, they have articles that they've published in scholarly journals refuting this. So there's a lot of places to go. But we'll start with Bart Ehrman, probably the leading anti-Christian New Testament scholar. He argues against inerrancy, argues that the Bible contains errors. He argues against the historical reliability of the New Testament text. He argues that we're not even sure we even have the best New Testament text, that a lot of passages he thinks the manuscript evidence is weak. We'll be refuting all of this in a future program. But he doesn't believe Jesus rose from the dead, doesn't believe Jesus is God, doesn't believe Jesus is the Savior. So this is not a friend, okay?
No, not at all.
Yet, Bart Ehrman, as the leading anti-Christian New Testament scholar, still he acknowledges that no serious historian or New Testament scholar should deny that Jesus of Nazareth existed in the first century A.D., and he acknowledges that he died by crucifixion. Now, he wrote a book on this subject in 2012 entitled Did Jesus Exist?, where he argues that Jesus did exist. And so totally refutes the Jesus myth hypothesis. And then we're going, this is enemy attestation. This is our opponent here. And in fact, he was on Reggie Finley's, I've been on there twice, but he's been on Reggie Finley's show recently and argued against Reggie Finley, who thought that all atheists should deny Jesus' existence.
Yeah.
And so if somebody wants to find that on YouTube, that's a real interesting interview where Bart Ehrman schools Reggie Finley on Jesus' existence. But here's a quote. Let me give you a quote from page 220. We'll give a couple other quotes from Bart Ehrman's book, Did Jesus Exist? Bart Ehrman says, and I quote, "At a reputable university, of course, professors cannot teach simply anything. They need to be academically responsible and reflect the views of scholarship. That is probably why there are no mythicists, those who deny Jesus' existence, that is probably why there are no mythicists, at least to my knowledge, teaching religious studies at accredited universities or colleges in North America or Europe. Their views are not widely seen as academically respectable by members of the academy." So that's page 220, Did Jesus Exist? On page 230 of that book, Bart Ehrman says, he argues there, that there is no unambiguous evidence for pagan dying and rising gods before Christianity, and no evidence that such gods were worshipped in rural Palestine. So there he's basically arguing that in the land of Israel, you just didn't have people worshipping pagan gods, and we've got no real evidence for pagan beliefs in dying and rising gods before Christianity. Yeah. So if borrowing occurred, they borrowed from Christianity, not the other way around. Now, he argues that even the enemies of Christianity admitted that Jesus was a real historical person. That's page 171 and 172 of his work. He says that early oral traditions about Jesus date all the way back to the early 30s A.D., to not long after his crucifixion. And he argues there are too many early sources written immediately after Jesus' life to deny his existence. He even points to the sermons in Acts 1 to 12 as being very early, and it all talks about Jesus existing. Bart Ehrman acknowledges that Paul knew about the historical Jesus, and he met Peter and James, and that James was Jesus' half-brother. So, you know, he's just straight out acknowledging, look, there's just no way to deny that Jesus, even the enemies of Jesus, of the enemies of Christianity, acknowledge that Jesus did exist. So there's no credible evidence against Jesus existing. And then he says that Jesus, even not only do we know that he existed, we know that he died by crucifixion.
Yeah.
Because no one, no Jew would have invented the idea of a crucified Messiah. So Bart Ehrman concludes that there is far too much evidence, too much early evidence for Jesus' life and his death by crucifixion. Now, you got to keep in mind, Bart Ehrman is the leading anti-Christian New Testament scholar, and he's saying, basically, there's no credible scholars that deny Jesus' existence. Now, he does mention Richard Carrier and Robert Price as credible scholars, but he says that they're like voices crying in the wilderness. They're outside the academy because virtually all New Testament scholars, all the leading New Testament scholars, virtually all the leading historians acknowledge that Jesus of Nazareth did exist, and that at about 30 to 33 A.D., he died by crucifixion. So, but most of this that we're hearing is coming from things like the Zeitgeist movie on the internet. And it's kind of these internet atheists that are real, you know, real lot of passion and not a whole lot of scholarship. But what we'll do is we'll address Robert Price's attack on the Jesus of history. And I got an opportunity to dialogue with Robert Price, debate him in an informal debate on Reggie Finley's show, Internet Infidels. Unfortunately, Reggie Finley, every time I was trying to respond to what Robert Price was saying, and believe me, there was a lot to respond to, a lot of baloney was being hurled that day, but every time I tried to respond, Reggie Finley interrupted with his own questions.
Being the non-biased moderator that
yeah.
he was.
Well, and I think Reggie's a good guy, so I think his heart was in the right place, but I don't think he realized. I think he just thought, okay, there's no way you can respond to what the great Robert Price just said.
Yeah.
Well, I beg to differ. I had objections to everything he said, although I knew I wasn't going to have time to voice all those objections. Certainly, I would have liked to voice some.
Yeah.
But Reggie had me answering his questions, and after I answered his questions, I managed to squeeze in a few objections. Like, I asked Robert Price, I said, well, you say you only accept what eyewitnesses report, and since you don't believe the biblical authors were eyewitnesses, something, by the way, that I am capable of arguing for. Mm-hmm. But you don't believe any of the biblical authors were eyewitnesses. But if you're going to deny everything that is not said by, reported by eyewitnesses, you're going to have to deny all of ancient history, all of first century AD history. He said, I'm okay with that.
That's pretty much everything 1800s and prior.
Well,
he would have to.
Well, no,
it's based on eyewitness, right?
Well, if there's eyewitness reports,
okay,
of Abraham Lincoln, he's okay with it.
Oh, okay.
And but first century AD, you don't have anything really from eyewitnesses except for the New Testament. But he denies that.
Yeah.
And so he says he's okay with throwing out all of first century AD evidence. That's how far the Jesus mythicists will go. But I told him, I said, yeah, but nobody else is okay with that.
Yeah, he's in a
all the
by
other
himself.
Historians on the planet Earth and the New Testament scholars, they're not okay with that. The evidence is clear that Jesus of Nazareth did exist. He was a Jewish man who was crucified around 30 or 33 A.D., whether Robert Price likes it or not. I even asked him, I said, well, do you deny the Holocaust? And he said no, but his answer was interesting. He said no, because my father liberated one of the camps. Now, my follow-up question was going to be, because it immediately came to mind, well, then your great-grandson should be a Holocaust denier, because he'll never have talked to an eyewitness of the camps. But I didn't get a chance to say it. Reggie broke in. I don't know if they let it go to a break or something. And then we came back, asked his own questions, so I didn't get a chance to respond to that. So if you wanted to know what Robert Price's views are, it's a good debate to listen to. But I would like a time debate with Robert Price, equal time someday, if we get the chance.
Okay. So, yeah, if you'd like to watch, like Pastor Phil has mentioned, Dr. Phil has mentioned earlier, that we just left the Worldview Apologetics Conference here in Bellevue. You can go to sermonaudio.com/IBD and look under Worldview Conference 2015 and be able to watch be able to watch all three talks that he gave. Excellent talks, and he deals with this, so it's really good information. That's all the time we got, so you can go to one or two of our websites, the instituteofbiblicaldefense.com or philfernandez.com. Click on the donate button, help us stay on the air if you like what you're hearing. I'd like to say hi to Richmond, Virginia, Huntsville, Alabama, and our friends in Albuquerque, New Mexico. That's all the time we got today, so wishing you all of God's blessings, and have a wonderful day. Bye. Hey, I'd like to welcome you guys to another edition of Bible Answers with Dr. Phil Fernandez, again here in the studios with Doc. And he, as you know, he's the president of the Institute of Biblical Defense and the senior pastor at Trinity Bible Fellowship. Also teaches Bible and philosophy at Cross Point High School located in Bremerton. This is Bible Answers with Dr. Phil Fernandez. How are you doing today, Doc?
Oh, doing real good. How you doing, Pat?
Doing good. Hey, so we just got back this weekend where you spoke with some of the greatest apologists, people that I've been watched or that I've been watching for years and reading about them and stuff. It was the Worldview Apologetics Conference 2015. We had it at Westminster Chapel located in Bellevue.
Bellevue, Washington, yeah.
Yeah, so I had the pleasure of recording all three of your talks, and you can go to sermonaudio.com/IBD. And they'll be up there. All three the talks will be there, and it'll be under Worldview Weekend Conference 2015. So you look at this series on his website, that page, and you'll see all three of them.
Yeah, and that was great to have, you know, to finally meet Ravi Zacharias, probably the leading
that was awesome
apologist. And then, of course, my old professor Norm Geisler was there and got a lot of photos taken with those guys. And then Professor Doug Guyvett from Biola, E. Calvin Beisner, great, brilliant scholar himself.
Oh, yeah.
And then that young guy, Pablo, I don't remember.
Yeah, I forgot his last name,
but really, really sharp guy. But it's put on by Carl Payne. He speaks there as well. But Dr. Carl Payne is the chaplain of the Seahawks, a good friend, and does a lot of really good work and promotes apologetics in the Pacific Northwest, where you and I know it's really, really needed.
Oh, yeah.
So, it was just a great opportunity to speak there. The crowd was really receptive of what I had to say.
Oh, it was awesome.
So
yeah.
I'm really glad that you were able to get out there and get it filmed and upload it to Sermon Audio. So that's good stuff.
Now, Carl Payne has a book. You gave it to me probably a couple years ago, Spiritual Warfare.
Yeah, he's had a lot of experience basically casting demons out of people and just a lot of crazy stuff. So he's done a lot of research on it, done his homework, and excellent book, recommended for anybody.
And we had a pleasure, and I'd like to thank you formally on the air, inviting us out to dinner. So we got to have dinner with Norman Geisler, Carl Payne, sat across the table from Doug Guyvett, Doug Guyvett. Phenomenal guy. I encouraged him to get his stuff out on the internet. It's amazing, this movement that he was talking about. But it was an awesome weekend. It was a highlight for me and my wife, definitely, to meet, to be with my rabbi, you, and Norman Geisler, together. It was definitely one of my check marks on my bucket list.
Yeah,
Have that. It was a fantastic weekend.
Yeah, we'll have to get you to meet Gary Habermas one of these days, too.
Yeah, maybe. See, he's the next one. Gary Habermas. Right.
We'll have to bring him up here or something.
Oh, yeah.
J.P. Moreland, William Lane Craig.
Yeah,
great
those guys.
Great guys.
Yeah, those are like the top, the creme de la creme when it comes to like the Christian apologists. And you are right. I mean, even with these guys in my eyes, the information and just being able to sit with you and learn for free. Have you in my sphere of influence is awesome.
I just love meeting these guys at the conference and hearing what they have to say. They're just brilliant minds. So
yeah, absolutely. Well, let's get back into your latest book, and we're still in it. We're still in the chapter 8, where we're talking about is Jesus just another myth? And you had one of those talks. Then you can go to your website and briefly give an hour overview of it with a lot of information. Hijacking the Historical Jesus, great book. You can go Amazon.com, look for Phil Fernandez with an S, and find it there, what, 15, 16 bucks, something like that?
I think even less. Sure. I think about $13.99, I think.
Okay, so. It's a great book. You got to have it on your shelf. So anyways, we're going to get right back into it. You were talking about, I thought, you ended up with like Dr. Price.
Dr. Robert Price. Yeah, and I kind of like the guy too, but his views are way out there. His basic view is that the early church borrowed ideas from pagan myths and invented Jesus. Jesus never really existed. Jesus was merely a myth. And so there's a lot of points to be made in response to that. Craig Evans, the New Testament scholar, himself said that this is just a revival of the discredited Christ myth theory of the 19th century. It was the history of religion school. And so Price wants us to ignore 150 years of progress in critical studies and go back to the old, you know, F.C. Bauer type view, and a view that's been discredited and refuted a long time ago. Now, the reason why Price believes Jesus didn't exist is because he assumes without evidence that miracles are impossible. So he believes miracles are impossible. So the incarnation, God the Son becoming a man, that didn't happen. The bodily resurrection of Jesus, that didn't happen. This miracle-working Jesus, that didn't happen. So his bias against miracles dictates his views about Jesus. So it's more his biases that drive him to the conclusion that Jesus never existed. It's not that there's a lot of historical evidence showing that he didn't exist.
Yeah, so he goes in there with a presupposition, and then based on his presupposition that he didn't exist, he lets that dictate the evidence.
Exactly. So he's assuming what he's supposed to prove. It's
exactly.
Called arguing in a circle. And another response we can give to Price is that the early church was rooted in Judaism. Gentile influence was minimal, if not non-existent. In fact, the key miracle for Jesus was his bodily resurrection. Yet any time you mention the resurrection, like Paul did on Mars Hill, the pagans would start screaming and think you were a nut or a babbler. And so the idea that that the early church borrowed the idea of Christ's resurrection from the pagans didn't have a concept of resurrection.
No.
It was only a concept that the Jews believed, the future resurrection of all believers. And then, by the way, little side note, little defense of the resurrection, the apostles would not have expected Messiah to, as an individual, rise bodily from the dead. They were just waiting for all the followers of Messiah to rise from the dead on the last day. And so it's not something they would have invented. But whatever the case, it's not something you can get from the pagan myths either. The Christian philosopher J.P. Moreland, in his work, Scaling the Secular City, he talks about the mystery religions, about the dying gods who came back to life. He says, look, these were never intended to be historical. Instead, they were associated with yearly vegetable cycles, vegetation cycles, like in the winter the vegetation dies, in the spring it comes back to life, and so they would have these little myths and stuff based on that. But the similarities with Jesus, says J.P. Moreland, are apparent. They're not real. See, the only way that these similarities sound like real parallels is if you talk about the pagan myths using Christian terminology.
Yeah, exactly.
Terminology that was foreign to these pagan myths. The pagan myths were polytheistic. They believed in many gods, whereas Christianity and ancient Judaism believe in only one God. They were also, the pagan myths were syncretistic. They liked to blend different religions, whereas Christianity and Judaism were exclusive. And that's why the Christians were being put to death, as were the Jews, by the pagan Romans.
Now, when you say syncretistic, do you mean, as an example, like the Sufi Muslims? They have, it's kind of like a mystery, it's like a Hindu and Islam kind of blended together. Is that what you're talking about? Kind of,
yeah,
like that idea?
Yeah, that's an example of syncretism.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
And that would be like when missionaries witness to evangelize Native American Indians. Some of the Native American Indians blended Christianity with their Native American beliefs.
Okay.
And came up with a hybrid that wasn't really fully Christian. Or in Roman Catholic missionaries witness to people in Haiti who are steeped in voodoo.
Yeah.
And the blending of the two. They syncretized it, and it came out to what we call Santeria,
yeah, exactly.
Which is not Roman Catholic or Christian in any sense of the word. And so this idea that, well, hey, we need to blend religions, that was an idea foreign to the ancient Jews and foreign to the ancient Christians who were Jews.
Yeah.
And also the pagan myths, Moreland points out that there were a non-moral context, whereas Christianity obviously has a moral context. Moreland argues there's no real resurrection in pagan literature until after 100 AD. So if borrowing went on, since the real parallels dated after Christianity, the pagans would have borrowed from Christianity, not the other way around.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of different things that can come into play here. Some of the other responses, Martin Hengel, one of the world's leading German New Testament scholars, he says that first century Palestinian Jews rejected pagan beliefs and practices. They were very exclusive, so they wouldn't borrow from them. And he also, the evidence is clear as well. Gregory Boyd and Paul Eddy point out for the existence of synagogues throughout first century Israel. So ancient Jews could read, and they would read their scriptures, the Hebrew scriptures. They wouldn't be, you know, they wouldn't be building their beliefs just based on stories that they hear, some of the stories being pagan, some of them being Jewish. In reality, they could read, and they could read their scriptures. That's why the Septuagint was a Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament 200 years before Christ walked the earth, because many Jews could still read. They just couldn't read Hebrew anymore.
Yeah.
And but whatever the case, it was a very exclusive Jewish faith that led to Christianity, not some borrowing from pagan myths. So in response to Price, Jesus was a recent historical person. There's excellent historic and early historical evidence for his life and works. I mean, you go back to the creed of 1 Corinthians 15:3-8. Paul says this creed goes back to the earliest days of Christianity. Even Marcus Borg and Gerd Ludmann of the Jesus Seminar date this creed to within 1 year of Jesus' crucifixion. And it says that the Lord Jesus Christ died on the cross for our sins according to the scriptures, that he was buried and rose again on the third day according to the scriptures, and then he appeared to Cephas, that's Peter. Then he appeared to the 12 apostles. He appeared to over 500 people at one time. He appeared to James. He appeared also to the apostles again. And then Paul adds to the creed, and last of all, he appeared to me also. This is early, early, early evidence, not only for the existence of Jesus, but for his resurrection as well.
Yeah, exactly. And to start a religion, and when you're looking at a different religion, and we're trying to get converts into what they were Pontius called it, just another a sect of Judaism.
There was, I can't remember if that was Tacitus or Josephus himself calls it a tribe of Judaism.
Yeah.
And so.
So you would have to have some kind of, like what we have like nowadays our statement of faith. This is what our church believes. So that's the same. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's how I look at it. That's like their statement of faith. Mm-hmm. This is what we believe. This is what actually happened.
Yeah, the Old Testament was their only Bible, but they had to go by the apostles' interpretation of the Old Testament,
yeah,
as taught by Jesus And so they got this from their from those ancient creeds or hymns, which were recited or sung in the early church before the New Testament was even written.
Exactly.
And that all points not only to a historical Jesus, but a risen Jesus as well.
Yeah, so now it's the Pharisees that believed. The Pharisees are the ones that believed in the bodily resurrection, and the Sadducees, or yeah, is it just the other way around?
Well, the Pharisees believed in a bodily resurrection, but of believers, of the true followers, but they didn't believe in Jesus' bodily resurrection.
Exactly, not his.
The Sadducees denied it altogether.
Yeah. So, again, look on sermonaudio.com/IBD to look for this sermon and almost 1,300 other sermons. Go to Institute of Biblical Defense and philfernandez.com. Click on the donate button if you'd like to help us stay on the air. It's been a wonderful time. Have a wonderful day. Thank you.